The Prime Minister of Greece is in Washington today. George Papandreou runs a country in the middle of a financial crisis. That crisis caused trouble across Europe because it affects the European currency, the euro. The Prime Minister says he is not seeking a bailout from President Obama. Papandreou is seeking global governance of financial markets, NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
When he was introduced at the Brookings Institution yesterday, it was pointed out that George Papandreou has something in common with President Obama. Both inherited a financial crisis, a theme likely to dominate their talks today. Papandreou says he was hit with the bad news when he became prime minister in October.
After we took office, we discovered that the budget deficit was actually double what our predecessors had told us, told European authorities and the Greek people.
Papandreou has already made the rounds in Europe, saying he's not looking for aid to bail out a reckless country. Rather, he's promising to carry out an austerity plan, cutting public sector salaries and increasing taxes, hoping that will reassure financial markets and make it easier for Greece to borrow the money it needs to get through this crisis. He also wants to see the world's biggest economies, the Group of 20, do more to regulate markets and prevent speculators from using complex financial instruments to bet against countries like his.
Together with my European partners, we have taken a common initiative to strengthen financial regulation, particularly vis-a-vis speculation. We need clear rules on shorts, naked shorts, and credit default swaps. So I hope that there will be a positive response from this side of the Atlantic to bring this initiative to the G20 in its next meeting.
While he discusses the big picture at the White House, an analyst at the Center for Global Development says the Greek prime minister would be better off just going down the street to the International Monetary Fund. Liliana Rojas Suarez is a former IMF official.
If the IMF designs a program that says, okay, you're going to do this kind of adjustment, but I will put the money to support that adjustment, the investor will say, okay, there is IMF money there, and therefore the credibility of the program increases.
The Greek finance minister is paying a courtesy call to the IMF, according to officials there, but a visit is not on Papandreou's schedule. The prime minister has had a series of other meetings, including with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who offered moral support.
Neither the prime minister nor Greece has asked the United States for anything. We support the steps that Greece is taking, but what I think Greece is looking for, as the Prime Minister alluded to, is that the United States working in the G20 will make some of the changes in regulatory regimes governing some of these financial instruments that have been used to the detriment not only of Greece but of other countries, including our own.
And as she and Papandreou discuss foreign policy issues ranging from the Balkans to Iraq, Clinton jokingly came up with another innovative way for Greece to plug its deficit.
And of course, Greece is the birthplace of democracy. So anytime there's a democratic election anywhere in the world, Greece should get a royalty, Prime Minister.
Papandreou said that certainly would help with his budget woes, though that's one drastic step he's not planning to take. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
We're back now with Omar Gayaga. And Omar, Google hopes to exploit some of these concerns. The tech giant is launching its own broadband service, Google Fiber, and lots of towns are lining up for the service. Tell us what's going on.
Right. We talked about this a few weeks ago at Google Gigabit. Several cities, including Seattle, Pittsburgh, I believe New Orleans, have kind of stepped up to try to put together a proposal to get Google's attention. What Google is doing is they're going to provide 1 gigabit internet service to a very limited area, probably about 50,000 people to start with. And this would be a boon to any community that had it. It would be much, much faster than internet speeds than what most of us are getting. And we would hope would spur innovation and new creative uses of the internet. Topeka, Kansas is actually in the month of March, renaming themselves Google Kansas to try to get Google's attention. So it kind of shows kind of what the demand is out there for this. I think especially in the tech world, we kind of lag behind other countries in our internet speeds, and 1 gigabit is much, much faster than any of us have ever experienced, probably.
That name, Google Fiber, I wonder if they focus grouped that because it sounds like breakfast cereal for people of a certain age.
As long as it's got extreme turbo turbo boost, I think we'll be happy.
Broadband's also been on Washington's agenda. This month, the FCC is unveiling its new national broadband plan. That's the Federal Communications Commission. Could this impact how we get on the internet at home?
Everyone hopes it does. Even the people who have problems with specific parts of what the plan is supposed to be, everyone hopes that this would provide faster internet speeds for everybody and to people in more areas. The chairman of the FCC is supposed to unveil that plan sometime this month, and we've been getting hints of bits and pieces of it. But really what it's trying to do is to free up wireless spectrum for more of these kind of mobile broadband services. It's also looking to expand internet to rural areas where people can't get a good, steady, fast internet connection. So the question is, will it be funded? I mean, there was one proposal in it that's $25 billion on its own, and with the economy the way it is, everyone's wondering whether Congress is going to approve all these measures. But everyone is in support of these things. It's just a question of whether they're going to be funded and how much of that will actually make it into the final plan.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks for having me. And we will be posting links to the speed tests and everything else on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
Thank you. That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and also for All Tech Considered. This is NPR.
American troops are starting to come home from Iraq, but many Iraqis have not yet returned to their homes. In the violence since the U.S. invasion, about 4 million Iraqis had to leave their homes. About 2 million fled the country entirely, and many are still outside its borders. Throughout the war, NPR's Deborah Amos has spent much of her time with Iraqis unmoored in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. Many of them are Sunni Muslims, a minority sect in Iraq, which is why her new book is called Eclipse of the Sunnis. And Deborah Amos joins us now. Deborah, welcome again.
Thank you very much.
Many people will know Deborah from guest hosting this very program. And although the book is primarily about Sunnis, it really seems, Deborah, to be a story of the abuse of minorities. In fact, early on, you tell the story of Iraqi Christians. Can you describe what that community was like before the war? I think it's unfamiliar to people.
Well, that was the first strand of the old Iraq that unraveled after the invasion. Before the war, Iraqi Christians were about 3% of the population. After the war, as Iraq became a more tribal society, the Christians found themselves trapped by Islamists who believed that they had no place in the country. And that's when much of the community began to move. The other thing to know about them is they had a place to go. There are vibrant Christian communities across borders in Syria, in Lebanon, and even in Jordan.
Was it in one of those Christian communities outside of Iraq that you first found a young man named Nabras Nasir?
It was. Nabras's story is so astonishing because it's emblematic of what happened to so many Christians during that time. He was living in Dura, which was a mixed neighborhood south of Baghdad. And he was a young man who, even in the height of the violence, still wanted to go to college. And every morning at 7, he would leave his house to go work on his applications. That brought him to the attention of a group of local al-Qaeda guys who thought that if he was going somewhere every day at 7 a.m., he must be working for the Americans. Mm. They kidnapped him, put him in a local jail, which essentially was a basement of a house, and he and 11 people were brought to trial. And all but Nabras were beheaded, and he was forced to watch all of these beheadings. He was eventually released, but they said to him, "Christians do not belong in Iraq." You should know that he is now in California. He has actually been given resettlement, although I think he will spend the rest of his life reliving those moments in that dungeon.
And, of course, we're talking about just one of the first groups to be targeted here, Christians. Very soon, Muslims were turning against one another, different sects of Muslims.
And this is the period where it is pretty universal. There were Sunnis leaving. There were Shiites leaving. They were heading for the exits. As time went on, and in Iraq there was a sectarian civil war, those numbers changed. It became a Sunni exodus. And this is what I witnessed in Damascus through 2007, even through the American surge. The primary sectarian orientation of exiles who were arriving in Damascus were Sunni. And this is where it stands today. The majority of the exiles are Sunnis.
And of course, what you're telling us there is that the majority in Iraq, the Shiites, turned against another very, very large minority, the Sunnis, and that refugee flow suggests that in large measure the Sunnis lost the civil war.
They did, Steve, and this was a historic demographic shift. And this is unusual in the Middle East. In the Middle East, Sunnis are the majority in almost every other country. And here's something else that's very new in an exile population. There's really no precedent for it. One of the things that happened during the invasion is Iraqis got all the technology that Saddam denied them, and they took to it immediately. They're on their cell phones. They're on instant messaging. They're watching satellite television. They voted in this election. They are still part of the community of Iraq, and I think of this country now as something that is a virtual country, much bigger than its borders. These refugees are watching politics. They pay very close attention. And so this crisis with refugees can't be ignored away because they aren't gone.
You also write a lot about women and children among these millions of mostly Sunni refugees now. And I say women and children because although there are men among the refugees, some men stayed behind, some men are dead. How have those women made a living?
One way to survive was to become a prostitute. And many, many of them did. And I've written a whole chapter about it because it was so hard to gain the trust of those women and get them to talk to me. It took me a long, long time to do it. And I eventually was able to go to one of these nightclubs and profile these women.
Nightclubs? What sort of nightclub?
Well, there's a band, there's alcohol on the tables, and then there is always a big round dance floor, and this is where the women go. They dance with each other, and the men dance with each other because any pairing is seen as a business negotiation, which doesn't happen till the end of the evening. And I spent some time in the ladies' room before the dancing commenced. And, you know, women open their cell phones and everybody's showing pictures of their kids before they have to go out and sell their bodies.
And in some cases, they're marketing children, aren't they?
They are. There has been a really tragic number of young girls and boys who have been trafficked. Sometimes it is parents who have trafficked their kids. I talked to some people in the UN who have been working on this issue. They'll sit a family down when they find out about it, and they say, look, we can give you $200 a month if you'll take your child out of this business. And the family says, $200 a month? She can make $200 a night. And this is a sign of deep despair.
Is this in some way, the presence of millions of refugees all these years later, something of an indictment of Iraq? For all of the improvements that have been described over the last couple of years, you have people who are living miserable lives outside their home countries, and still they don't feel secure coming home.
One of the reasons I wanted to call this book The Eclipse of the Sunnis is because I thought that part of the story has been underreported and misunderstood. They are a testament to how far Iraq still needs to go. You can have a vote. You can have democracy in the country. But here's the problem. Majority rule is not really democracy. In the way that democracy works in our country, we have the rule of law. We have protections for minorities. We have religious protections. That is still missing. And as long as that is missing, these refugees will not come back because they don't feel they have protections. They don't feel their children have a future. And so that is why it's still a crisis.
Deborah Amos, NPR correspondent, familiar voice on this program, and author of Eclipse of the Sunnis. Deborah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Among the stars presenting statuettes at the Academy Awards last night was Tyler Perry. He was an executive producer of Precious. The film won Oscars for Best Supporting Actress and Adapted Screenplay.
They just saved my name at the Oscars. I better enjoy it because it'll probably never happen again.
Tyler Perry is a tall, handsome guy who's written, directed, and starred in half a dozen hit movies, mostly centering on women. But here's where the probably never happen again comes in. Perry became a star playing a foul-mouthed grandma with a gun.
I ain't scared of no popo, call the popo, honk on the popo.
On stage and screen, Madea made Tyler Perry into one of the biggest names in black entertainment. As NPR's Neda Ulibi reports, Perry is spinning his popular success into an opportunity to tell more serious stories.
Tyler Perry, triple threat, makes hit movies, TV shows, and plays about fractious families.
Hell to the no, this is blasphemy. Our daddy was a saint.
Your daddy was a pimp.
About women in romantic distress.
For goodness sake, you see a man touching all over me, and you do nothing about it. You call yourself a husband. You are a punk.
And when he's not producing two successful cable TV shows, Perry is not afraid to put on a dress and stomp around playing Medea, a grandma who literally praises the Lord and passes the ammunition.
You see, when I got saved, thank you. I mean, when I saved the rest of them bullets.
Perry clearly gets an enormous kick out of playing his signature character, a rowdy old hellraiser who thumps kids when they're sassy when she's not threatening to shank them. Tyler Perry admits his work is not exactly highbrow.
What people forget, because I'm often criticized because the movies are so predictable and so simple, I'm writing for 2-year-olds to 90-year-olds. My fan base is so broad, so I tell a simple story on purpose.
Perry's stories rely on a blend of faith and comedy to appeal to a largely female, largely Christian audience who've transformed this former high school dropout into one of the entertainment world's most formidable new figures. But the criticism he's received has been harsh. Filmmaker Spike Lee used racially loaded words to describe Perry's TV shows, coonery and buffoonery. Melvin Peters is a professor of African American literature, and he says Spike Lee has a point.
When you look at those shows, buffoonery comes into it. Black woman slapping a man upside the head, telling jokes about the crackhead woman character.
Next time you on crack, pick me up one of those $20 Rolexes.
You're on perilous ground when you present these things as humorous, you know? I mean, what crack has done to the African American community, African American women in particular? These are troubling things, you know.
But Perry says he is passionate about telling women's stories. It's always been the basis of his artistic drive, as well as the source of his financial success. Still, Perry's approach to women's stories has recently diversified, dramatically.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine.
The movie Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, could not be more different from Tyler Perry's previous projects. Precious grapples with social problems seriously. It's artsy, disturbing, and new for Perry, critically acclaimed. But what attracted Tyler Perry to the film was his identification with the main character, an obese, illiterate teenaged girl abused by her mother, played by the actress Monique.
So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me?
You know, my mother was my protector growing up because I was in a house like the one in Precious, and my father was Monique's character. So she would take me everywhere with her to protect me. So I went to hair salons, and I went to the Lane Bryant, and I would listen to all these women, you know, a little boy listening to all this. I soaked up everything. So a lot of times when I'm writing, I'm thinking about those women and those experiences.
Tyler Perry's used those experiences for his movies, TV shows, and plays throughout his entire career. He says Medea comes from the same place as Precious. She's based on real women who have also been his intended audience.
Now, though, Perry wants his stories about women to have a broader reach.
I've kind of painted myself in a box with the Tyler Perry brand.
While he's not going to abandon Medea, Perry says he'll soon retire her for a while.
It's very risky. It's very risky on so many levels. That's why I started this other company to do these types of films.
Perry has essentially started an art house division called 34th Street Productions. It's named for Miracle on 34th Street because Perry says his life is a miracle. In his 20s, he lived in his car while writing a musical that eventually found a following in the black theater circuit. Now, not two decades later, Perry owns a massive movie studio in Atlanta. There, he's now filming an adaptation of a play that embodies the revolutionary thrill of black feminism and identity politics in the 1970s.
My spirit is too ancient to understand the separation of soul and gender. My love is too delicate to have thrown back in my face.
Written by playwright Entezake Shange, for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough, ran on Broadway and was earlier filmed for public television.
My love is too beautiful to have thrown back on my face. All right, y'all.
My love is too take it to the bridge to have thrown back on my face.
For colored girls is a staple of black literature courses, like the ones taught by Professor Melvin Peters.
Entezake Shange is a writer of great intelligence and great stature, and her work is classic.
The play lyrically delves into different aspects of black womanhood through a chorus of seven actresses, colorfully identified as the Lady in Red, the Lady in Yellow, the Lady in Blue.
Orange butterflies and aqua sequins and sconce dream slight bosoms. Silk roses darting from behind my ears. The passion flower of Southwest Los Angeles. Meanders down Hoover Street.
You know, the story was so rich, and I didn't know, because it was written, you know, when I was born, and I didn't know how powerful and how amazing it was.
In fact, Tyler Perry did not particularly care about For Colored Girls. It was acquired by a member of his staff, and for a while, he says, it was nothing but a problem.
We were kept giving notes and couldn't get the script right, and we couldn't figure it out. So I finally started paying attention to it, and I was like, wait a minute, whoa, this stuff is great.
The notion of Medea directing For Colored Girls shocked some black intellectuals. Tyler Perry does not blame them.
I'm shocked, too. I think they have every right to be shocked. And I've even seen outrage. How dare you touch this? We don't want this to be this way. But rest assured, there'll be no Medea in the movie. And they can also rest assured that I'm going to stay very true to what Entezake's done.
And maybe Tyler Perry can help guide the play to a new generation of young women, says African-American literature professor Melvin Peters.
As long as he doesn't play one of the roles.
Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls began filming last fall. He's scripting, directing, and producing it. Perry's been cagey about the cast, but it's rumored to include friends like Oprah Winfrey and Jill Scott. The movie is scheduled for release next year. Tyler Perry's latest romantic drama, Why Did I Get Married 2, will be in theaters next month. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're about to listen in this part of the program to some voters' concerns about health care. We will also remember just what a health care bill really contains.
We're doing that on the morning after President Obama tried to sell his health plan outside Washington, D.C. He traveled to Arcadia University in suburban Philadelphia to make the case one more time for Congress to pass health care legislation. He went after Republicans for their unified opposition and attacked big insurance companies.
NPR's Don Gagne covered the Obama campaign and yesterday attended an event that evoked it.
This is likely the end game for health care legislation for this year. So in his final push, the president is taking his message outside of Washington, making a simple, direct case about what's at stake.
I want to spend some time talking about this. The price of health care is one of the most punishing costs for families and for businesses and for our government.
He said people in Washington worry more about how the health care bill will affect the November election. while ordinary Americans are being forced to go without health insurance.
It forces small businesses to choose between hiring or health care. It's plunging the federal government deeper and deeper and deeper into debt.
And in this narrative, the president's leading target is the insurance industry.
And the insurance companies continue to ration health care based on who's sick and who's healthy, on who can pay and who can't pay. That's the status quo in America, and it is a status quo that is unsustainable for this country. We can't have a system that works better for the insurance companies than it does for the American people.
This was a friendly crowd. Many were students who cheered when the president said he wants them to be eligible to stay on their parents' health care till age 26. Also in the audience was Jill Fink, who owns a local coffee shop employing 35 people. She says the president's plan will indeed make it easier for her to provide health insurance for those workers. After the speech, she described herself as optimistic, but
I'm confident in his plan. I'm not as confident that Congress will pass the plan.
Ann Fink says she never imagined the process would drag on as long as it has.
For me, it seems like such a no-brainer and something that just makes sense for so many people and so many Americans that it's baffling to me that it's been more than a year and we're still having the same conversations.
Not everyone was supportive. Standing near the back of the audience, Jack O'Brien would occasionally shout out his disapproval, once even causing the president to pause briefly. Afterward, O'Brien, a self-employed electrician, said he opposes the bill because he believes it will use federal dollars to help cover abortions. And he said the entire package is way too costly.
We can't afford it. Our country cannot afford this bill.
Asked what he thinks should be done to deal with ever-rising premiums, O'Brien said he's not in a position to say.
I'm not an insurance insider. I don't know what could be cut and what couldn't be cut.
But O'Brien added that more government involvement is not the answer. Still, that was a rare voice of flat-out dissent yesterday. Far more common was the complaint that the president should have been making the case this forcefully months ago. Ed Lichtstein is a 62-year-old school counselor.
Should have come sooner. We need that specifics. We need it now. And he was holding off for such a long time as exactly what his plan was. Maybe he should have had it sooner.
The president ended his speech just as he did so many times during the 08 campaign, urging his audience to spread the word, to pick up the phone, to knock on doors. Mr. Obama's own push continues tomorrow with a similar event in St. Louis. Don Gagne, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Finally, a few words about Women's History Month. It started as International Women's Day, which is today. We'll be observing it with conversations that showcase interesting and hopefully unexpected takes on the role women have played in the life of this country, just as we did with Black History Month, which just ended, and as we plan to do with Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which comes in May, and Hispanic Heritage and Native American Heritage Months, which come later in the year. Now, some people wonder why we have these so-called Heritage Months, and some take it even further to get all retro-racist about it. Black History Month seems to spark an especially egregious outpouring of stupidity. Cotton balls were sprinkled outside an academic building at one Midwestern campus last month, and of course you heard about the Compton Cookout on this program, which was an off-campus party held by a fraternity associated with the University of California at San Diego, where the white revelers were encouraged to act out as many racist stereotypes as they could fit in the course of getting their drink on. Okay, we get the point. You don't like black folks or assertive women or whoever. You think they're getting too big for their britches or are, as one student at UC San Diego put it, ungrateful. And he added the N-word for extra spice. Can I just tell you, it's the opposite. It is the speaker of those words who is ungrateful and ignorant. Too many people who no doubt think of themselves as well-informed are somehow unaware of or indifferent to the contributions of women and people of color to the progress and development of this country, which is why these Heritage Months exist to begin with. But even more egregious, it seems, as though too many people are willfully unaware, intentionally ignorant, or just refuse to acknowledge the truth. I'm reminded of this just about every time we post our blog or open the mail. One of the reasons I'm glad we have a blog is that the rest of the world can now be made aware of the kinds of things reporters, especially reporters of color, have known all along, which is just how many people out there cannot wrap their heads around the idea that people other than propertied white men have contributed anything significant to this country.
The Pulitzer Prize winner Leonard Pitts wrote a column about an exchange he had with a reader who just denied that a Medal of Honor winner who was black had deserved it. Couldn't have happened, this reader insisted, because blacks weren't officially assigned to combat positions until years later, which is precisely the point. Just as women are in harm's way now, even if they aren't assigned such roles, it makes uncommon bravery that much more noteworthy. But this reader didn't want to hear all that. He just preferred to act as if these events never happened. There are all manner of historical deniers out there, of course. Now, most people don't spend too much time on them or prefer to assign them to the lunatic fringe. And the people who spend a lot of time challenging those views, well, don't we look a little askance at them, too? Don't we kind of smirk and say, well, nobody believes that nonsense, that women shouldn't lead, that blacks aren't smart, that Latinos and Asians and Native people are whatever. But evidently, some people do believe those things. New research shows that parents who refuse to talk about race are really just making it taboo. Now, I'm not naive enough to believe that if you present everybody with the same information, they'll come to the same conclusions. That's not the point. But those of us who believe that reality should have some meaning have to speak up. If we don't provide the information, we cannot reasonably argue that people should know it. And if the truth doesn't set you free, well, I don't know what will. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.